going to start. I can see I need to turn it up a little bit. Okay. I'm going to start now. And as I explained before, the screen is down because I want to be able to show the inauguration after I finish the lecture. And I can't adjust anything with the screen up. And it doesn't work at the moment, but someone is supposed to come over and fix it. So I'm going to write on the boards on the side for the moment until they fix it or I give up. I'm not going to make a lot of announcements today. Almost everything is on the web. I just do want to remind you that I do have office hours today and that the Surf Symposium is Friday. And this is an opportunity to get a little bit of extra credit and also to have a good time and to get some free food all at once. And if you can't make it and you want another opportunity for extra credit, you have to email Naya or me before the symposium. All of this is explained in excruciating detail on the website. So I think I will leave the announcements for now. Maybe we'll make a few later. And what I want to do today is I want to start by summarizing what we had learned last semester, that is the story so far, where we are, what we're going to take for granted, and what we're going to do this semester that's different than last semester. Now, last semester, the major question really was how do living things work? That part isn't going to change at all. But last semester, the emphasis was on prokaryotes. And this semester, we're going to shift the focus to eukaryotes. But first, what did we figure out about a typical prokaryotic cell, such as E. coli? We were concerned largely, although not in the section with genetics, but we were largely concerned with the macromolecules inside the cell. And this semester, we're going to look at things that are bigger. We talked about things like ribosomes, which are assemblies of macromolecules. But this semester, we're going to talk much, much more about these larger structures that are either within cells and are assemblies of many macromolecules, or we're going to talk about structures that consist of many cells, such as tissues and organs and so forth. Now, what did we learn last semester? There were actually, when you talk about how the cell works and the macromolecules, there were really five big issues that we concentrated on. And I want to list them because we're actually going to concentrate on them again. It's just that we're going to apply it to something different. So what are the big issues? One of the big issues was structure and function. Now this can be considered one thing or two. I'll call it two. We're extremely interested in the question about how function is rooted in structure. How does a particular structure of a macromolecule enable it to do its job? And the only difference this semester is we're going to look at bigger things like chromosomes and ask again, how does their structure allow them to do the job? How are these two related? Now, it's all well and good to have a structure that works, but you also have to know how was it made? How was it synthesized in the cell? So manufacture or synthesis is a big deal. So we're going to talk about structure, function, synthesis. And it's not enough, as we know now, to just make something. You have to make it at the right time and the right amount, and you have to control how well it works. So regulation is a big deal. Now, this is four things. There's a fifth one that we actually started talking about at the end of the term in the fall. And this is the issue of not just How do things work? But how did they get to work that way? Why is it that things work in the way they do? Some of it makes sense, but some of it is very peculiar. And some of it is clearly arbitrary. The fact that we have, say, L amino acids instead of D. Why do things work the way they do? And to a large extent, this is rooted in their origin. It is rooted in their evolutionary origin. So, we talked a little about this at the end of the semester. We'll talk about it a lot more this semester. So last semester, we were concerned with the structure-function relationships, manufacture, regulation, and origin of macromolecules and eukaryotic and prokaryotic cells. And we're going to have the same issues this semester, but we're going to apply them to eukaryotic cells and to bigger things than simply macromolecules. Now, you notice up here, I wrote sort of in the corner, methods. One of the things that we're going to be concerned with, which is really no different than last semester, is the methods that are used in order to figure these things out. How do we know that things work in this particular way? So the methods are going to be big. Now, in the notes, for today, all of the methods are lumped at the end. But we're not actually going to do it that way. We're going to talk about the methods when we get to an issue that requires them. And we probably won't talk about all those methods today. That's why I wrote here, probably next time, the method described on 1B, we probably won't get to till next time. We'll talk about some other methods, but we probably won't get to that one. So all the methods are together for reference, but we'll talk about them when it matters. What did we figure out from doing this? We spent a lot of time, and you did an awful lot of problems last semester, about structure and function and manufacture and so forth. And what did you learn? And you could summarize what we've learned in the central dogma of molecular biology. That the bottom line is DNA makes RNA, and RNA makes protein. Now, to fill it in, you have to put in this part. Not only do we talk about transcription and translation, but there's also the issue of replication. How is the DNA copied and passed on so that not only one E. coli works, but both of its descendants do as well? And the biochemical part of the class, in a way, is the final one. How does the protein do a job? We concentrated on enzymes. Not all proteins are enzymes, but many of them are. And whatever the protein does, either as a catalyst or some other function, it has to do its job. And if you put in the job and the replication, this pretty much summarizes what we did last time. Now, this implies that the only function of RNA is a middleman to help the DNA make protein. We know this is not true. We know that RNA has other functions as well. Some of them are relics of evolutionary past, and some of it is just we didn't get around to figuring it out yet. Some of this is mentioned on handout 1D. 1D, and also the one that has no marks at all, come from a recent issue of Science. At the end of each year, Science magazine has a special issue with a special section, and they talk about both the big findings of that year, and they make predictions for the next year, and then they look back the predictions they made for this year, how did it pan out? So I've taken some selections from there. In particular, is it all set up to go?
Yeah.
So what do I have to do?
The IP.
I have to put that in?
Yeah. It's not that it's there, but I just got a call.
Oh, you got to find out?
No. I'll enter for you if you want.
Sure.
This thing is the center screen?
Excuse me a second.
Sorry. You could open that one here. So when you want to display it, put it down.
Okay, so you can leave all that and do it. Fabulous. Thank you. Okay. So the business on 1D summarizes some of the things that are either breakthroughs of the year or carryovers from last year, but which relate to stuff that you learned last semester and that you might find interesting because hopefully you know all that stuff. So 1C builds on what you learned last semester. The article that has no marks on it at all is about something we're going to do this semester. It just so turns out that what they call the breakthrough of the year, which is the study of stem cells, is in fact something we're going to talk about in a little bit. I'm going to explain in a minute where it goes in the class, but we're not going to actually get to it for a while. So that handout is a foretaste of what we're going to get to, and Dr. Heiklin is actually going to give the lectures on development, and you should hold on to that and read it, and we'll get back to it later. Now, we've already said that the questions are sort of the same this year, this semester, and this year, which is, how do things work? What is the structure-function correlation? How are they made? How are they regulated? And what is the evolutionary origin of the current state of affairs? And we've already said that we'll concentrate on eukaryotes instead of prokaryotes and bigger things instead of macromolecules. Now, there are two very big issues that come up when you start talking about eukaryotes that we didn't have to worry about when we talked about prokaryotes. There are two features of the eukaryotic lifestyle that are really important. And they are the compartmentalization of each individual cell and the aggregation of cells into multicellular organisms. So let's write that down. It's compartmentalization of the cell and multicellular organisms, or multicellularity. In a bacterium, there is only one compartment. It's like a one-room house. But a eukaryotic cell has separate compartments. You've already met some of them, mitochondria, and we've referred to nuclei. And the compartments in the cell are surrounded or bounded by membranes. So they're said to be membrane-bound. So instead of having the equivalent of a one-room house, you have a complicated house with many different rooms. And this is important because if you have multiple areas in the cell, each surrounded by a membrane, you have to think, how do things, when they get made, get to the right compartment? This is a really major issue. How do you put them in the right place? And what these structures are and how the things in them get to where they go is, in fact, what we're going to talk about in the very beginning of the class. So this semester, the first part of the semester, is going to be about the consequences of compartmentalization. We're going to talk about the structures of membranes that separate the compartments and how you get things from one compartment to another and so forth. And all of that is called cell biology. If you talk in terms of fields, last semester we did biochemistry, we did some genetics, and some of that was eukaryote, and we did molecular biology, which some people think of as just being the overlap between the top two. But this semester is different. We're going to talk first about eukaryotic cell biology, which is actually the consequences of this first feature of eukaryotes. Now, this next part of the class is going to be about the consequences of this second feature of eukaryotes. Because we're going to talk about how you make things, how you get them to the right area, how you turn genes on and off, and so forth. But then we have to consider, if you have a multicellular organism that has individual cells in it, how do the various cells cooperate? This is not a problem so much for bacteria. Each individual cell is a self-contained unit. But in you, you have zillions of cells, and they have to be coordinated. Your head has to know what your feet are doing, and your feet have to listen to your head. And if they don't, you're in big trouble. So how is that done? So in order to discuss that, the next thing we're actually going to talk about is maybe not a field in itself, but we're going to talk about signaling. How does one cell send a message to another? And there are two ways, of course, this is done. It's done with chemicals, and it's done electrically. So I'm going to talk about chemical signaling first, and then Dr. Feierstein, a neurobiologist, is going to talk about electrical signaling. Now, this signaling is really only interesting so we can figure out how a multicellular organism works. And there are, you could say, two parts of it. One is how it actually works. Once you have a thing such as yourself or your liver, how does it do its thing? And that's generally called physiology. Going to talk about how every single part of your body or any organism works. We're going to take selected parts of the body and show how everything we've learned enables that part to work. Now, there are, in a way, two aspects of physiology that we're going to concentrate on. I've already mentioned the coordination of the major operation. If you decide you want to go outside and listen to watch the Obama inauguration on a screen, your feet and your head and your arms and everything have to be coordinated. So that's one kind of coordination. But another kind is maintaining your internal milieu more or less constant. The pH of your blood is more or less the same, no matter where you are, what you eat, what you do. Similarly, the concentration of ions is the same. Your temperature is the same, etc. How you maintain a constant internal environment so you can respond and your muscles will work and your nerves will work and all that stuff, that's a very important aspect of physiology, and that's called homeostasis. We'll spend a lot of time talking about that. Now, there is another aspect of multicellularity that you probably didn't think of. It's related to the manufacture issue. It is not, how were you built? It's not enough to just have all the right proteins and all the right cells. Somehow, all the cells have to be in the right place. You started as just a ball of cells. The zygote went through mitosis, you had a whole ball of cells, and somehow some of them specialized to be brain, some of them specialized to be liver, cells moved around, and somehow you built an organism. And that organism stays. Your liver cells don't decide to turn into kidneys. And the question is, why are some cells able to turn into this or that, but only do it at the right time, and some cells stay the way they are? And all of this is lumped together as the problem of development. If physiology is how you run a multicellular organism, development is how you build it. And Dr. Heitland will give a few lectures on that. And that's where the stem cells and the Breakthrough of the Year article from Science come in. Now, at the end of the class, we're going to add a few more things. I'm going to talk a little bit about immunology. Either today or next time, we're going to talk about antibodies as a tool of the laboratory, as a technique or method for figuring things out. But we're going to put off talking about the biological function of antibodies until the very last, almost last. And one of the reasons for that is that the system, the immunological system, is different from every other system in some very important ways. And it's also one of the most complex. So we're going to talk about that at the end. And finally, we're going to have one more lecture on cancer. Because of many factors, including the Jewish holidays, We're going to skip one lecture, and the last lecture is going to be on study day. But because I know there is so much material and it all gets crammed in at the end, I've decided that this lecture is going to be on the first study day, but the material in it is not going to be on the final. So this is a bonus optional lecture. You can come if you want. You don't have to. We will talk, I hope, at some point in here about how the cell cycle is controlled. And then in this last lecture, about what happens when it goes berserk, which is, and you get cancer. What do we know about that? How do we know it? And what are we hoping to do about it? Now, this is arranged in a semi-logical order. But it isn't exactly the logical order I would pick, in part because what with all the scheduling issues and vacations and holidays and so on, and the availability of Dr. Heitland and Dr. Feierstein, this is not totally exactly what I would do if I had my druthers. So as a result, there are a few things in here that we're going to have to squeeze in somewhere or pick up later, and it won't be 100% continuous. And we'll try to make that as clear as we can as we go. But more or less, this is what we're going to do, and in this order. Now, this is enough in the way of an advertisement. And what I want to do next is to actually talk about to do it. I want to start by talking about cell biology. I want to start talking about the structures that are peculiar to eukaryotic cells. In other words, if you look at a eukaryotic cell, what do you see that you didn't have in a prokaryotic cell? What is it? So let's take a closer look at a eukaryotic cell. Let's suppose you got out a light microscope and you put a typical eukaryotic animal cell under the light microscope. What would you see? Now, I didn't give you a handout for this because it's so simple you can draw it yourself. You would see something that looks like this. This is the cell. You would see that it has an inner compartment, the nucleus, and an outer compartment, the cytoplasm. Now, in my picture, I have drawn a boundary or a membrane around the nucleus and a boundary or membrane structure around the edge of the cytoplasm. But the truth is, you can't see a thing. In the light microscope, there is no evidence of there any structure here. You can't see a thing. All you can see is that things look different on one side and they look different on the other side, so there must be something there. So there's an inference of what is called the plasma membrane. You infer there must be one, and you infer that there must be a nuclear membrane, but you can't actually see them. Now, what other structures can you see besides the fact that there's a subcompartment in the nucleus and there's the cytoplasm? Well, you can see mitochondria because they're quite large. And that's what this structure is. Mitochondria, which are found in animal cells and plant cells, they're found in virtually all eukaryotes, are about the size of bacteria, which has implications, as we'll explain later. If this were a plant cell, it would also have chloroplasts, which are about the same size. Now, there's one other thing that I showed here, and one more I forgot to put in. There's an area of the nucleus that stains more darkly, and this is known as the nucleolus. You can't tell if it has a membrane or not. You can't tell anything about your structure, but it's clearly distinguishable from the rest of the nucleus, just as the nucleus is distinguishable from the rest of the cell. And I've drawn one other organelle or piece in here that you can see in the light microscope. And that is, in addition to the mitochondria and the nucleus, there's something that appears to be in the cytoplasm. Its structure varies from cell to cell. You can't see it very clearly. It's not clear if it's an artifact, but it stains with some dyes, and it's named after its discoverer, the Golgi apparatus. But exactly what it is, what it looks like, can't tell. Now, the point of this is you can't see very much in the light microscope. And you would like to see more. Now, you can increase magnification with the light microscope, but it doesn't help. Things just get bigger and blurrier. And the reason for this is you run into the issue of the limit of resolution. Suppose two things are very close to each other. If they're close enough, you can't distinguish them. You can't distinguish one from the other, and it looks like one thing instead of two. With your eye, with your naked eye, what controls the limit of resolution is the structure of your eye. But with a microscope, what limits the resolution is not the lenses, but the wavelength of the light that passes through the microscope. When you pass electromagnetic radiation through a sample, what limits the resolution, how close things can be before you can't tell them apart, is the wavelength of light. The resolution is approximately limited to half the wavelength of light. Lambda over 2. Except I drew my lambda backwards, but I'm sure you get the idea. So what are you going to do? There's a little table in your notes that you can refer to later, that if you use the eye, the limit of resolution is about a tenth of a millimeter. Things that are closer than that cannot be distinguished. Now, if you use the light microscope, you can get down to 0.2 micron, which means you can magnify things by about 100-fold, about 1,000-fold, compared to what you can see with the naked eye. But even if you blow things up 1,000-fold, you can't see enough details of structure to see what does the nucleolus look like, what does the Golgi look like, what does the membrane look like. So you need to be able to get better resolution. And traditionally, the way that's done is to use an electron microscope. Instead of passing photons through your sample, you pass a beam of electrons. Electrons have a shorter wavelength, and therefore you get better resolution. Now, there are actually two kinds, basic kinds of electron microscopes. The regular one is the transmission electron microscope. You're passing a beam of electrons through your sample, and just like with the light microscope, if it's dense, they don't get through. If that part of the sample is not so dense, the electrons get through. So you're measuring density from the point of view of an electron. And using that, you can get, in practice, resolution of 1 to 2 nanometers, which allows you to get 100,000x compared to what you can see with the eye, or 100x compared to what you can get with the light microscope. Now, there's another variation on the electron microscope, which is the scanning electron microscope, or the SEM. Now, with a scanning electron microscope, you irradiate from an angle, and that knocks electrons out of your sample. And then those electrons that are scattered are detected. And that allows you to detect the shape of surfaces. It gives you a pseudo 3D picture. Now, the resolution isn't as good. It's larger than with the transmission electron microscope. So your resolution is worse, but your magnification is less than with the transmission electron microscope. But you get to see surface features and 3D features. Now, we'll explain today some of the things you can see just from looking at pictures in the electron microscope, but I remind you that the trouble with the electron microscope is that your sample has to be deader than a doornail. And you can't look at living cells. With a light microscope, you can look at living cells. So there's some things easier to find with one, some with the other. And if you read further or work in a lab, you will discover there are many variations on this, many other kinds of microscopes, which allow you to see one feature or another. But these are the ones we're mostly going to talk about. Now, here I talked about a nanometer, a millimeter, and a micron. I'm sure you've all heard these and you know theoretically what they are, but it's hard to keep in your head how big these things are and the sizes of things that we're interested in biology. So I want to explain that for a minute. One way of defining biology is by the size of the things that you look at. If it's too big, it's physics. If it's too small, it's chemistry. And if it's even smaller, it's physics again. So biology owns the middle. So the biggest thing we ever look at in biology, at least biology of organisms, can be measured in meters. Whales, dinosaurs, you can measure them in meters. You don't need kilometers. Meters will do. Now, a thousandth of a meter is a millimeter. And small organisms are measured in millimeters. From the point of view of things we encounter every day, a pinhead is measured in millimeters. That gives you some idea of what we're talking about. Now, a thousandth of that is a micron, or a micrometer, because it's 10 to the minus 6 meters, symbolized by mu. And cells are measured in mu. Eukaryotic cells are 50 to 100 mu in diameter. Prokaryotic cells are 1, much smaller. There's a little table in your notes also with some typical sizes. Now, in biology, we also use a thousandth of that, which is a nanometer. Nano at the moment is big. Because people, things of this dimension are just being studied now and being used in many technologies. But we need nanometers to look at cell parts. If you want to look at whole cells, you talk in microns. If you want to look about cell parts, you need nanometers. And you can see that to look at things that are nanometer in size, you have to use the electron microscope. Now, sometimes we look at things that are a tenth that size. And the unit of a tenth of a nanometer is an angstrom. Chemical bonds are measured in angstroms. Distances within macromolecules are measured in angstroms. Anything smaller than this, chemistry, physics, forget about it. So this is the range of things we have to deal with. And for looking at cell parts, the electron microscope is the most useful. And it was developed in the 30s and used in the 50s extensively. And it's still in use today. Now, what can you see if you look at a cell that would look like that in the light microscope? What would it look like if you looked at the same cell in an electron microscope? And a diagram of that is on handout 1A, showing the major features that you need to know. So let's take a look at that. Okay. So here is our cell. And the first thing noticeable is that when you look in the electron microscope, you can actually see membranes. Now remember, what you've done is to kill cells, fix them, stain them basically with heavy metals, make a thin slice, and look at the slice. But when you look at it, you can actually see, if you blow this membrane up, it actually has structure. It actually looks like this. It has two dark lines and a light line in the middle. So you can look at this as a three-layer sandwich, but people usually call it a bilayer, because it has two layers of lipid in it, as we'll discuss next time. So you can see that the membrane is real. There's a layer around the cell, the plasma membrane. Now you can also see that there's a membrane around the nucleus. There's actually two. Now, we've drawn it here in our picture something like this. One way of thinking about this membrane is it's actually two layers of membrane, not one. What you see there is what you would get if the nucleus was surrounded by two layers of membrane. Now, what does this mean in terms of lipid and bilayers? This is one bilayer, two layers of lipid. This is a second bilayer. So this is actually two membranes. But things have to get in and out of the nucleus. So it's as if we punched holes in it, and in our picture there, there are three. And where the hole is, the two membranes have fused. And now you're left with these pores which allow things to get in and out of the membrane. Now, because the finished structure is this sort of flattened double layer, flattened double layer, flattened double layer, people, instead of talking about two nuclear membranes, talk about the nuclear envelope. And that's the two membranes together. That's this whole thing. Now, we'll talk later about the details of each structure of each of these parts. Today, what we're interested in is the big picture. Now, can you see anything in the nucleus? Well, you do see, remember the nucleolus, the special structure in the nucleus? You can see that it has no membrane. We'll see later, this is a staging area for assembling pieces of ribosomes. It's not surrounded by a membrane. It's just an area of the nucleus where certain things are concentrated. Now, one thing that you do notice is that there aren't any full ribosomes in the nucleus. The ribosomes are out here in the cytoplasm. We think that the parts of a ribosome are assembled in the nucleus, but they do all their protein synthesizing out in the cytoplasm. Now, while we're talking about ribosomes, you notice there's some more ribosomes in this picture. That the outer surface of the nuclear membrane has some ribosomes on it. And that the outer layer of the nuclear membrane is continuous with a bunch of other membranes. And that some of them also have ribosomes. So there are two kinds of ribosomes in the cytoplasm. Those that are not attached to a membrane and those that are attached to a membrane. Now people talk about free and bound ribosomes. But they're all bound to something. What would that be?
mRNA.
Has to be messenger RNA. Remember, ribosomes don't lie around whole. They lie around as subunits. When it's time to make protein, two subunits clamp onto a message. So both are bound to message, but only one is bound to this kind, is bound to the surface of a membrane. Now, the other thing that you have to remember about this picture is that this picture is a thin slice or a cross-section of a three-dimensional object. So what that means is that, for example, this is just the slice through a membrane. So that membrane extends out this way. So this structure represents a flattened sac which has been sliced. This structure represents something round which has been sliced, etc. And there are pictures in your books which try and reconstruct it in a more 3D way, which I think is very helpful. Now, you notice here that we have the nucleus, what's inside this nuclear envelope, and the outer nuclear membrane is connected to more membrane. But you have this space in here, the inside of the nuclear envelope, and that's called the perinuclear space. And that space is continuous with or connected to the space inside the other membranes. This combination of membranes is called the endoplasmic reticulum, or the ER. And it consists of a series of flattened sacs and tubules. Its exact shape varies from cell to cell. The amount of it varies from cell to cell. And it's divided into two parts. You notice that some of the endoplasmic reticulum has nothing on it, no ribosomes, and some of it has the little bumps. So the endoplasmic reticulum, or the ER, is divided into the smooth ER, or the SER, and the rough ER, or the RER. And the only difference is whether the ribosomes are attached or not. And notice that the two parts are continuous. The smooth ER is connected to the rough ER. Now, we have here both membranes that act as boundaries and spaces within the membrane. The perinuclear space is one. Another important space is what's inside the ER. In general, when you have a space enclosed by cells or a membrane, the space is called a lumen. So the ER there, this is the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum, the space inside. Now, there are many other structures shown here in the cell. Remember this Golgi thing? You couldn't tell what its structure was from looking in the light microscope. But when you look in the electron microscope, you see that the Golgi is generally a series of flattened sacs. Just as the amount of endoplasmic reticulum varies from cell to cell, so does the amount of Golgi. And these sacs, remember, this is a cross section. So that means there's like a pancake, or more like a pita with a hole in the middle, and another pita, and another one, and we've sliced through the whole thing. So each of these also has a lumen or a space inside, and they're always associated with vesicles. Eukaryotic cells have lots of vesicles, or little round things of membrane with something inside. And different ones serve different functions. It's pretty clear that these are involved in some way in moving things from one part of the Golgi to another. But exactly how is not clear, and we'll come back to it. Now, the endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi and some of the vesicles, in addition to the ones that I just drew, there's some others, which I'll put in. Some of these vesicles, the endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi apparatus, are all considered part of one system called the endomembrane system, or the EMS, which does not here mean the emergency medical services, but the endo, meaning inside the cell, membrane system. Now, why is this considered a system instead of just three membrane-bound sections? Because it's involved in a single function and there's a physical relationship. The endoplasmic reticulum, some of the vesicles, and the Golgi are all involved in the packaging of proteins. Remember we said a protein has to get to the right place? It's not enough just to make it. They transport proteins both in and out of the cell and to different parts of the so-called endomembrane system. Now, these things, the endoplasmic reticulum, the vesicles, and the Golgi, are all separate physically. They're not connected. But vesicles can butt off one of them and fuse with another part so that things can be moved around from one part to another. And that's why it's considered a single system, because material can be moved by the formation of vesicles from one part to another, as we'll explain in a minute. Some of the vesicles involved here are involved in transport, in moving things from the endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi, from the Golgi to the endoplasmic reticulum, from the Golgi to the cell surface, etc., etc. There's one other kind of vesicle which is associated with the endomembrane system which you should know about, and this is called a lysosome. This is a type of vesicle. Now, what does lysis mean? Remember, lytic viruses break open their hosts? This vesicle contains enzymes which, if released, can digest the cell. So it works the other way around. These are the recycling bins. When you have material to be chopped up or degraded, it is stuck into one of these lysosomes where the resident enzymes help chew it up. Now, there are other places that chew things, but this is a major one. Now, to tell you the sort of short version of the story, which I'll tell you about later in more detail, it's thought that proteins that are supposed to leave the cell are made on these attached ribosomes, sent into the ER, sent from there to a transport vesicle, sent through the Golgi, then through another transport vesicle, and then empty out to the cell, out to the outside of the cell. If they're going to... proteins that end up in lysosomes those proteins go through the Golgi into the lysosome, but then those don't leave the cell. Those vesicles stay in the cell. We will talk about all of that in great detail. The point that I want to make now is that the Golgi apparatus, the lysosomes, the endoplasmic reticulum, and assorted transport vesicles are all considered part of the endomembrane system. There are other vesicles which are not part of the endomembrane system. They serve different functions. They have a different origin. They contain different enzymes. A classic example of this, another kind of vesicle, is called a peroxisome. Now, I'm going to explain in a few minutes how we know that lysosomes and peroxisomes are different. But first, what I want to do is come back to something that I said. I said that material can be moved from one part of the endomembrane system to another by the formation of a vesicle. How does that work? So now you want to look at the bottom part of your handout where we've drawn an example of how that works. So here we have two compartments in the cell. One of these could be a piece of the endoplasmic reticulum with its lumen and its surrounding membrane. One of these, say, could be the Golgi with its lumen and its surrounding membrane. But these are two different membrane-bound organelles, and there's something inside one of them. How is it that the something, the pink stuff, gets from one to the other? So I'll just label the two organelles A and B. So the idea is that there is an outpocketing of the membrane on A. so that the material, which is going to be moved around, which is sometimes called the cargo, ends up in the little bud of A. And then the membrane bud pinches off. So now our picture looks like this. Now our cargo, our material that's being moved around, is sitting in a little vesicle. It's not in A anymore, it's not in B anymore. And now that vesicle can fuse with B. It can cozy up to B, and the two membranes can actually fuse. And I had to draw this on the next line in my picture because I didn't have room, but the picture now looks like this. Now you realize it's completely reversible. Exactly the same thing, process, could get something from B to A. Because looking at this picture, I mean, I drew the arrows in, but I could have drawn the arrows the other way. The idea is you can form a out pocket. Your material gets into the out pocket, it buds off, and in fact, so you can move things this way from any compartment to another compartment as long as it's part of the endomembrane system. Now, what did we move? We moved the pink stuff. We moved the cargo, but that's not the only thing we moved. We also moved a patch of membrane from A to B, or if we did it the other way, from B to A. So this system delivers both cargo, or material in the lumen, and it delivers patches of membrane from one part to another of the endomembrane system. Now, because it moves membrane, this whole process has to be balanced. You understand if it went only in one direction, all the membrane of the cell would end up in one organelle. So in fact, it has to be balanced that when we're carrying something over, we take the container or patch of membrane and send it back. Now, this ability for membranes to form vesicles and fuse with other membranes and deliver things, this is a property that appears to be unique to eukaryotes. Prokaryotes don't do this. And this allows eukaryotic cells to do something else very important. Here, this allows cells to move membrane and cargo from one organelle to another. But it also allows them to move things in and out of a cell. When things are moved into a cell, it's called endocytosis. When they're moved out of a cell, it's called exocytosis. And your picture, your handout, actually has a picture, if we go back to your cell, of exactly this happening. If you look over in this part of your cell here, and I'm going to erase a little bit and clear it up to make it easier. Or maybe I just redraw it over here. If we consider in your diagram, on the upper left part of your cell, we've got three little vesicles here that look like this. Now, what's going on here? Is this exocytosis or endocytosis? Where is the orange stuff going? Out or in? Oh, yeah? Why do you know it's going in?
Because why would it be in a membrane inside if it was going in?
Well, suppose I added this picture. It seems perhaps intuitive that the cell would be sucking things up and this would be going in. But in fact, exactly the same picture would be observed if the cell was making the orange stuff and sending it out. If that were true, though, you'd have somewhere out here it would be making the orange stuff. So this picture looks basically the same whether the cell is carrying out endocytosis and capturing the orange stuff and bringing it in, or whether the cell has made or wants to discard the orange stuff and is in fact sending it out. The only way you can tell the difference is providing orange stuff which is in some way marked or labeled. You need to follow in time what's happening in a cell to see if orange stuff is going in or whether orange stuff is going out. You can't tell from this picture. But the same process that allows you to move material from compartment A to compartment B allows you to move stuff from outside the cell to inside in a vesicle, or from inside in a vesicle to outside a cell. So material can be made on the rough ER, put in the lumen, packed into a vesicle, sent to the Golgi, passed through the Golgi, sent into a vesicle, and sent out the cell. And when you make proteins that are secreted, that's how it works. Well, how do we know what goes on in the different parts of a cell? It's time to think about one of those methods. I said that a protein gets made here and stuck into the ER. And we, in fact, know that certain modifications to the protein happen in the ER. And different modifications happen in the Golgi. Now, how do we know what happens in the Golgi and what happens in the ER? How do we know it's different? That what's going on in here is different than what's going on in there. There are two classic methods, and the first one I want to talk about, which has been used actually to distinguish this two, is a biochemical method. How do you find out what's going on? What you really want to know is what enzymes are in here and what enzymes are in there. Because if you have a pretty good idea of what enzymes are where, you can tell what's going on. But how are you going to find that out? One traditional biochemical method is what people call grind and find. Now, what they mean by this is traditional methods of cell fractionation. That means that you grind the cell up or break it in some mechanical way. You make a solution of cell parts, and then you separate those parts using the kind of methods we talked about last semester. Last semester, we talked largely about separating molecules. Here, we're talking about separating cell fragments, each fragment being either an organelle, a piece of an organelle, or whatever. But you use the same methods. You use mostly ultracentrifugation. Now, we said last semester, you can use sedimentation velocity or sedimentation equilibrium in an ultracentrifuge. Now, what's the difference? Sedimentation velocity is how fast something moves, which depends on how big it is. It depends on the ratio of the mass to the friction. On the other hand, equilibrium density, as used in the Meselson-Stahl experiment, measures the density of something, which usually depends on the ratio of lipid to protein. You can separate light things from dense things. So using these two methods of ultracentrifugation, you can separate the parts of the cell, either on the basis of size or on the basis of density. And you can break this cell up then, and using the ultracentrifuge, you can usually separate, say, the nuclei from the vesicles, from the Golgi, from the pieces of the ER. So now you have a solution which contains either organelles or pieces of a particular organelle. And now, how do you test what enzyme is there? I have a little test tube. I want to know if an enzyme's in there. What do? I provide substrate. And I ask, is it turned into product? If the enzyme is there, the reaction will go at a significant rate. If the enzyme is absent, it'll take forever. So you provide substrate and say, is it converted to product? In other words, you do a traditional enzyme assay. So what you do for grind and find is you break the cells open, you fractionate, you separate the parts, using ultracentrifugation or other methods, and then you assay each part for enzymes. And you figure out which enzyme is where. And that has allowed us to largely figure out what goes on in the various parts of the cell. Well, remember Remember I mentioned there are two kinds of vesicles. I said there are lysosomes and there are peroxisomes. Both are somes. Both are vesicles. However, if you use grind and find methods, you cannot separate them. If you break the cells open and you separate the pieces, you find that they're vesicles, and the vesicles have certain enzymes in them. But the question is, you get two kinds of enzymes. You get oxidases, and you get enzymes for lysis or degradation. You get degradative enzymes. Now, the question is, are these in the same vesicles? Does the cell contain one kind of vesicle with a mixture of enzymes? Or people suspected that the cell actually contained two kinds of vesicles, and the oxidases were in one kind of vesicle, and the degradative enzymes were in a different kind of vesicle. But the trouble is, if there were two, you couldn't tell using grind and find. Why? Because if there were two kinds of vesicles, they couldn't be separated. Meaning they had the same size, and they had the same density. So if you use traditional grind and find methods, you just had a mixture of vesicles. So you have to use a different technique. Just to show that there are actually two different populations of vesicles, what you need to use are a second method of measuring which enzyme is where, which are called in situ assays or in situs. In situ means in place. The trick here is not to break the cell open, but to take a flattened cell, feed it substrate, and see where it makes product. The advantage of fractionation is that the enzyme assays are easy to do. But when you break the cell open, maybe the enzymes leak out of here into there. When you do an in situ assay, the assays are quite difficult to do. But if you find enzyme activity in a particular place, you know it's really there because you didn't break the cell up or mess the cell up. You left the cell in place and asked, where is the enzyme? So how do you do it? The idea here is that you have your flattened cell and you provide a substrate that gets into the cells. Now, where will that substrate get turned into product? Everywhere? Wherever the appropriate enzyme is. And only there will you make product. But you don't want the product to float off. You want wherever the product is formed for it to stay. So that you can say, aha, I got product in the Golgi, but I didn't get any in the ER. So the way you do that is you use substrate which is soluble, but when it's acted on by the right enzyme, it makes an insoluble product. Therefore, once the product is formed, it precipitates and stays in the cell at the place where it is made. And the product not only has to be insoluble, it has to be detectable. It has to be electron dense if you want to find it in the electron microscope. It has to be colored if you want to find it in the light microscope. So it has to be insoluble and detectable. So what people were able to do is they had a substrate for the oxidases and they had a substrate for the different substrate for the degradative enzymes. And they showed that if you use the substrate for the oxidases, one set of vesicles formed product. And if you use the substrate for the lysis type enzymes, a different set of vesicles formed product. There were clearly in the cell two different sets of vesicles. One had oxidases, one had degradative enzymes. But they were in different vesicles. And so the peroxisomes are the vesicles that have the oxidative enzymes, and the lysosomes are the vesicles that have the breakdown or degradative enzymes. These two have certain things in common. They are the same size approximately. And they both have a single membrane around them. And they both contain material that is dangerous when loose, that will eat up the cell if you let it. But they are different in the function they carry out, in the fine points of how they do it, and in how they're made. The lysosomes are part of the endomembrane system, but peroxisomes are not. And we will return to the details of that another time. Now, while we were at it, we should mention one more organelle in the cell, and those are the mitochondria or the chloroplasts. If you look at mitochondria in the electron microscope, and I think I drew a mitochondria in your picture, you can see clearly that it has two membranes, not one, which we've already discussed last semester. It has the luminar matrix in the middle, and it has two layers. Now, we think that what mitochondria and chloroplasts are the remains of bacteria that were captured by their host cell millions of years ago and have gradually lost some of their properties. They can't live independently anymore. But if you look at your picture, you notice I drew some ribosomes in here. No, I didn't. I drew the little F1s, but I didn't draw the ribosomes. Mitochondria and chloroplasts contain DNA, and they contain what's called a genetic system. They have all the necessary ingredients to use that DNA to make proteins. So they have their own DNA and their own system for transcription and translation. However, they don't have very much DNA, and they don't make very many proteins. So the idea is that the ancestral organism was able to make a whole set of proteins. But with time, most of the ability to make proteins has been lost. Most of the genes have been lost. And most of the proteins that end up in a mitochondrion are made out here. Also for a chloroplast. Most of the proteins for a mitochondrion or a chloroplast, the DNA for the instructions is in the nucleus. The protein is made in the cytoplasm, and then the protein is stuffed into the mitochondrion. But a few proteins are still made inside the mitochondrion or the chloroplast. These are probably the very hydrophobic ones, which for manufacturing purposes, it works better to make them inside. Now, I should say that mitochondria and chloroplasts are enormously important. We talked about the function of mitochondria last semester. Chloroplasts are similar in that almost all of the energy that cells use to run on comes from them. Plant cells have both mitochondria and chloroplasts. Mitochondria use chemicals to derive energy. Chloroplasts use light energy, use light. But eukaryotes wouldn't be able to get enough energy to build and run a multicellular organism if the cells didn't contain mitochondria and or chloroplasts. And of course, the great dream is someday to figure out by genetic engineering how to have a patch of cells here that has chloroplasts in it, so you know you just go out on a sunny day and you don't have to eat lunch. That doesn't seem too likely, but it's a nice idea. So we just to summarize the ribosome business, we've said then that there are three kinds of ribosome in a cell. You notice that there are ribosomes in the mitochondria, and there are ribosomes in the cytoplasm. So you have the ribosomes in the mitochondria or chloroplast, too, if it were a plant cell. And then the cytoplasmic ones are either free in the cytoplasm or bound to membranes. And we'll discuss in more detail how these three work, that clearly the ribosomes in the mitochondria have some bacterial features, and they make some of the essential proteins of the organelle. The bound ribosomes make the proteins that are destined from some part of the endomembrane system or outside of the cell. All the the other proteins are made on free ribosomes. So all the proteins that end up in the cytoplasm, the nucleus, most of the mitochondrial ones, peroxisomes, this free ribosomes make most of the proteins. Now, we've said that the eukaryotic cell has the special feature of having membrane-bound organelles, such as the Golgi, peroxisomes, lysosomes, endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondria, etc. Ribosomes are special structures. Some people call them organelles. Most people consider them a different category. They're complicated, but they're not surrounded by a membrane. They're perhaps best seen as machines rather than as organelles. There is another kind of complex structure unique to eukaryotes, which is very important. And that's this one, the cytoskeleton. There is a structure of fibers inside the cell that helps maintain its shape. That's why it's called the cytoskeleton, which is also involved in other features, including movement. Now, we're going to talk about it mostly next time. I just want to set it up. The cytoskeleton is a series of fibers. The proteins of the cytoskeleton generally do not have enzymatic activity. How do you find a protein that has no enzymatic activity? In both grind and find methods and in situ methods, you use the enzymatic activity of the protein to find out where it belongs and what it does. But cytoskeletal proteins have no activity. So what feature do they have that is unique to them? Every protein has a unique structure. So in the case of them, they are not found by their enzymatic activity, but by their structure. What you do is you make antibodies which recognize those unique structures. And the antibodies stick to the parts of the cytoskeleton, and that allows you to find out where they are, how they move, and so forth. And I'm going to leave that, and that's on handout 1B, how that works, but we're not going to start that. We're going to talk about that next time. Now, I'm supposed to be able to set this up so that we can watch the feed, so I'm going to try and do it. From last semester, but it seemed to me that most people were probably more interested in watching the inauguration than getting their exams. So if you want to come up and ask me for them after I get this thing set up, if I can, I'll be happy to give your exam back. But I will bring them again on Thursday, and I will bring them tonight. Or you can come during office hours and pick them up. Doesn't want to work.